This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. About 2 years ago, North Carolina's Chief Justice brought together business leaders, academics, attorneys, and judges for a top-to-bottom examination of the state's judicial system. 2 decades had passed since the last review, and this month that group issued its recommendations. Previous reviews of the state's court system resulted in the establishment of district courts and focused attention on funding and on judicial independence. What recommendations does this new study make? We're going to find out this hour, and we welcome the co-chairs of the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice to fill us in. Catherine Arrowood is a partner at Parker Poe in Raleigh and is former president of the North Carolina Bar Association. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Barbara Jackson is an associate justice with the Supreme Court of North Carolina, and she, along with Catherine, is in a studio at WUNC in Chapel Hill. Welcome to you. Good morning.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let me begin with you, Barbara Jackson. What was the impetus for the Chief Justice, Mark Martin, to call for this review?
The chief had come up with a series of 7 issues he was interested in looking at during the course of his campaign, and this is how it came to fruition. He pulled together co-chairs in 5 different areas. I was tasked with chairing technology. Catherine was charged with legal professionalism, and the 3 others were civil justice, which Dean David Levy at Duke Law School chaired, criminal investigation and adjudication, which retired magistrate Will Webb chaired, and public trust and confidence, which was chaired by Brad Wilson, who's the CEO of Blue Cross Blue Shield.
And Catherine, I mentioned that you co-chaired this commission that came up with these recommendations, and that the commission, as Barbara just pointed out, was comprised of business leaders and academics and attorneys and judges. I understand the involvement of attorneys and judges because you interface with the court systems every single day. But why academics and business leaders?
Well, it was important to hear what's going on outside of North Carolina. And we were able to get a lot of information from academics for that point of view. Second of all, the way in which our courts operate is extremely important for the business environment. If we do not have courts that are not only handling disputes for businesses efficiently, but also handling disputes for individuals who are employed by those businesses in an efficient way, we have a really serious problem. And the Chief Justice was very interested in being sure that this commission had points of view from as wide a segment of our population as possible.
Would it be accurate to say that the courts in North Carolina and probably around the country are used more by average citizens than they are by business owners?
Oh, I think that's certainly true. When you think about things like traffic tickets, child custody, divorces, collection cases, that's where the millions and millions of cases come from. And often the defendant or plaintiff in those cases are individuals.
So why make up the commission of business leaders, academics, attorneys, and judges? Why not ordinary citizens as well?
We had ordinary citizens as well. And in fact, I think Justice Jackson can address that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think one of the really important things that we did was we had a good cross-section of folks that were working on the actual committees. But once we finished our interim work, we took our case to the public. And we had a series of public hearings across the state of North Carolina. I know I chaired the one down in Wilmington, and we heard from attorneys down there, judges. But we also heard from a lot of citizens who had some real great real-world stories to share with us.
To talk about that, what did emerge from those public hearings from ordinary citizens? Did anything strike you as something that you didn't anticipate hearing?
I don't know that this was unanticipated, but one of the things that came up in Wilmington that was particularly compelling had to do with raising the juvenile age, which is one of the Chief Justice's central initiatives with this report. And the father talked about a young man who had some type of learning or developmental disability and how his family expected him to take responsibility whenever he did something. So when he ran into an issue that brought him into the court system as a teenager, his family had him take responsibility. And I have to say, most of us who are lawyers wouldn't think of having a child go into the court system without being represented because we know it has long-term consequences. And for him, it has had long-term consequences. He's had difficulty being employed in North Carolina. When he left the state and was up in Maryland, he was a valued employee at the Baltimore Orioles. But when his family returned to North Carolina, his employment's been really there's a real barrier to his employment that's caused by this long ago plea of guilty and taking responsibility.
There were 65 people on the commission. Who chose the individuals and how were they chosen?
You know, that's an interesting point. I would describe it as a very collaborative process. I think that there was clearly an effort to bring a balance to the commission just as much as possible, both in terms of people's personal points of view and their personal life experiences. You know, I know that with regard to the committee that I chaired, I had consultation with the Chief Justice from time to time about people he was thinking about putting on that committee. And, you know, he was very, very thoughtful. And I was, when I saw the final list, I was just extremely pleased with the both geographic and there are about 50 different categories of points of view that he somehow managed to put together in the full commission. It was a very good process, I think.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The technology committee was a little bit different.
Yes.
We were operating under a charge from the General Assembly in addition to the charge from the Chief Justice. Our charge was to develop a strategic plan for technology, and the General Assembly had mandated that certain categories be represented on our committee. So it was a slightly different, but again, just as Catherine said, had a lot of back and forth with the chief and AOC about who would be a good fit for the committee.
And Catherine, you've also made a point of saying that partisan politics did not factor into the work of the commission. How were you able to keep it out?
Well, you know, as those of us who were chairing committees where we had some folks who had very definite points of view, it was our job to be sure that those points of view got heard. It was also our job to be sure that the opposite point of view had its chance to come to the surface. And I have to say, on the Legal Professionalism Committee, we had quite a number of law school deans on my committee, and they have lots of points of view, as you might imagine. We had a very civil and very appropriate discussion on all the issues that came up, and it was up to the committee chairs to manage that. I think in general, that is what has led to what I view, of course I'm biased since I was a co-chair, as a very fine report, and one that I hope that will guide us in the coming decades as we wrestle with how to bring justice to the citizens of North Carolina.
Justice Jackson, before this all began, the Chief Justice talked about the need for this thorough review of the courts and for a plan to strengthen the courts within the existing framework, but this is a top-to-bottom review of the court system, and that seems to be a daunting task. Where did you begin? How do you decide how to begin on something like that?
Well, it's interesting. I have a page of the report open, and it has a quotation that I think is probably very apt. Judicial reform is not for the short-winded. this is not a sprint. It's a marathon. And there are certain things that the Chief Justice and the Administrative Office of the Courts will be able to undertake without outside authority, and there are other things where we'll be asking the General Assembly to help us with things, for example, raise the age for juveniles. But, you know, we've got a good foundation in place with this report, and we have a blueprint for where we can go. One thing I did want to mention, too, one of the groups that has not been mentioned that was represented throughout and that's critical to the operation of the judicial branch is the clerks. There is a county clerk in all 100 of North Carolina's counties, and their experiences are very diverse based upon population, access to technology and broadband, and a variety of different subjects.
Both of you are intimately aware of the current system in the courts and the current challenges and problems in the courts and because you interface with it every single day. But in the course of doing this review, in the course of interfacing with all these other people, citizens, the other 65 people involved in the commission, did things emerge from this that you did not know were wrong with the court system? I would think going in, you had your own opinions about what was wrong, what could be improved, what was right. Did something emerge that you didn't know, you didn't think about yourself?
Well, Justice Jackson mentioned that she chaired the town hall meeting in Wilmington. I chaired the one in Greensboro. And the thing that struck me was a very heartfelt story from a young woman who had been in our district courts dealing with child custody and child support issues. And, you know, these are issues that I probably should have known about, but I practiced primarily in Superior Court. It was not something that was terribly familiar to me. And her points, the points that she made about how our courts are not accessible because we lack the technology for our citizens to be able to access their own case file and to be able to check on the status of where their case is in the court system, really struck me as a fundamental problem that I hope that our legislature will work with the courts to fund a complete change in technology. Now, Justice Jackson chaired the Technology Committee, and they have provided, I think, a very thoughtful series of recommendations. But I think we can't lose sight of the fact that although technology is a sophisticated and complicated issue and it requires money to deal with it, at the end of the day, those technology issues hit right at home with an individual single mother who is trying to raise her children. And we need to keep those people in mind as we think about how we change the court system for the future.
And we're going to talk about technology because, as you point out, they're probably a little behind the times in the court system. And it does take money because it takes money for hardware, and it takes money for software, and it takes money to interconnect all that information throughout the state. But one of the previous commissions that did something similar to what you've done here with overhauling the court system took place in the 1950s. It was the Bell Commission. It sought a unified approach to the courts in all 100 counties around the state. And, Catherine, you have said that the court system operates today essentially the way it has since the 1960s when some of these Bell Commission, ideas came into play. And you've said that since the Bell Commission recommended its unified approach, it's been threatened by rapid changes in technology and increases in our state's population. Talk about that. Explain that.
Yes, the Bell Commission resulted in creating what we call the unified court system. We have district courts that deal with domestic and juvenile and misdemeanor criminal matters, the superior courts that deal with larger civil matters and criminal matters, including felonies. It created the State Court of Appeals, and it readjusted the Supreme Court. So it was a pretty substantial top-to-bottom reform. That court system has worked, you know, pretty well over the years, but we have a number of things that have happened in North Carolina that really cause us to need to relook at that. One is the explosion in our population and where people live. You know, we have some counties that have very small populations, yet they have a full-time court staff in operation. We have some counties that have a huge population and are really struggling to try to provide bring justice, if you will, to their citizens. And so the population explosion is something that we have to keep in mind. Second of all, people tend today to want to go to the web. You know, if you get sick and you look up your symptoms on the web and get some idea of what's wrong with you, that's not necessarily going to cure you. But people like to get their information from the web. And we are somewhat restricted in North Carolina in how accessible that information is to our citizens. So that is something else we need to take into account. Additionally to all of that, we are really need to kind of rethink about how we select our judges, how we select our clerks, and how all of that operates. And I think this commission, although we did not make recommendations on all of those issues, provided the basic research ground, the groundwork, if you will, for thinking about those issues in a smart way.
Catherine Arrowood is an attorney with Parker Poe in Raleigh. Barbara Jackson is an associate justice with the North Carolina Supreme Court. Together, they were co-chairs of the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice, recommending changes to our court system. We'll talk about those when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Goodwill Industries of the Southern Piedmont, dedicated to breaking barriers to employment, training job seekers, and offering health care and banking at the Goodwill Opportunity Campus. Information at goodwillsp.org. And Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering comprehensive heart care, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. Well, in the waning days of the campaign, candidate Donald Trump issued a contract with the American voter, a to-do list for his first 100 days in office. That milestone is coming up on Saturday, though the president has called that benchmark a ridiculous standard. Three political scientists compare promises made to promises kept and share their thoughts on what has to be done to check things off the president's list. That's all tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, a grand new counter-trend strategy for global order. Big foreign policy thinker Anne-Marie Slaughter says embrace connections, not borders. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking today with the former president of the North Carolina Bar Association, Catherine Arrowood, and Associate Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, Barbara Jackson, co-chairs of the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice. I want to come back to something that you were talking about prior to the break, and you talked about the challenges that particularly large counties like Mecklenburg and Wake have in their judicial system versus some of the smaller counties because of population growth and technology. So are you saying that in these larger counties where the population has just boomed over the years and where technology has not kept up, that these things together could actually be affecting the outcomes in courtrooms around the state?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think it affects the outcomes. I think it affects the ease of use of the court system. Some of the larger counties, Mecklenburg and Wake, and in particular Forsyth County, have done some work on their own to advance technology. I know Susan Fry, the clerk of court over in Forsyth County, has brought in someone to help make things easier for the citizens of Forsyth. And we were very happy she was on the technology committee. She was a great contributor to our committee. I think it's more ease of use than outcomes.
And you said, Barbara Jackson, that you headed up the technology committee, and Chief Justice Mark Martin at his investiture ceremony in 2015 talked about the need to make the courts more efficient and make better use of technology. So this is one of his pet projects, I guess, for lack of a better term. What would improved use of technology mean to the courts? What would it look like to the average person using the courts? How would you describe how the courts use technology today, and what kind of technology do you have at your disposal today?
Well, it's interesting. North Carolina, back in 1996, was the first state appellate court to start utilizing e-filing. Now, it was a little bit of a misnomer because the file would come in electronically, and then it would be converted to paper. Happily, we're converting a heck of a lot less paper today, and a number of us, myself included, are working in a virtual environment. But for the public, I think the big thing is the front door to the court system or our website. And this isn't as specifically mentioned in the report, but we are undertaking a year-long project to redo this court's website so that it's going to work well on a mobile phone or a tablet or a laptop or however you want to use it. I think that's going to be a great access issue. In addition to which, it will have to be ADA compliant, which our current site is not. And it's going to have a number of features that are going to be extremely helpful for the public. We hope to be able to have folks be able to resolve their problems via the website sometimes. Perhaps if they've got a traffic infraction or something that's not serious, they'll be able to negotiate with an assistant district attorney through their my phone rather than having to spend 2 hours waiting at the courthouse.
Is this a matter of developing new software or buying software that's already been done and or hardware, or does the hardware exist and the software just needs to be upgraded? And where's the money coming for all this, I guess?
Well, our AOC has been a good steward of finances, so I don't think they're asking the General Assembly for any additional money this year. At some point to get full-blown electronic filing throughout the court system, there will have to be some type of capital investment. I can't speak to every county's equipment and means. One of the issues that the court system has is that we don't control the local courthouses. Those are controlled by the county commissioners. So where you've got state-of-the-art courthouses in Wake County, Mecklenburg County, and Durham County, some of our poorer counties just simply don't have the tax base to make that happen. Mm-hmm. That's going to continue to be a bit of a challenge, and I think there are other states out there with the urban-rural issue that have similar challenges.
But if we have a unified court system, why isn't the state kicking in to make everything equal?
We do with the equipment. For the court employees, the equipment is there, but we don't control broadband access, for example, to our more rural counties, and really the state doesn't control that. That's a consumer-driven need.
Mm-hmm. So it may not exist. Is that what you're saying? In certain counties, high speed broadband access may be hard to come by.
Exactly,
that's true.
And just one more thing. One of the concerns too is, you know, with the body cameras that our law enforcement officers are starting to wear, those files are tremendous to transmit through the court systems, electronics. So we do have some challenges like that ahead of us, but we're aware of them.
One of the things that you mentioned, Barbara Jackson, a second ago, is the hope to go virtual with all of the paper, no paper, everything electronic. And one of the things that society has relied on since the beginning of the judicial system, really, has been the treasure trove of records that's stored in every courthouse in the country. And as we move to electronic storage, questions arise about the permanence of those records. No one really knows exactly how long files on a hard drive will remain stable and readable. And gosh knows, the software that reads them, the file formats, have changed immensely since just the 1980s and 90s. Is there some worry that you won't be able to go back in 100 years or even 50 years and read these files?
There certainly is. You know, the gold standard that our state library still has for archiving materials is microfiche and microfilm. So there's still, you know, digital archiving still is not the gold standard. And I have to be honest, it's beyond my pay grade to understand more than that. But I think that, you know, the fact that we're not positive about exactly how this is going to work in 100 years. Mm-hmm. One example, lots of court records in eastern North Carolina have been destroyed through floods and hurricanes. You know, so there's no chance of retaining those records except possibly reconstructing them. But if you have a digital system with a repository offsite or in the cloud, those records are going to remain intact.
Okay. In the report that you've issued with these recommendations that we'll talk about, you say that 53% of the public believes that outcomes in the courts are fair only some of the time or not at all. 63% of the public believes that cases are not handled in a timely fashion, and only 42% of the public believes that the courts are sensitive to the needs of average citizens. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that is one of the things that the Chief Justice did at the very beginning of the study was to commission a survey. And it was, I think, very helpful to those of us who were co-chairs because it told us what I think many of us had perceived. And that is that we have eroding confidence in the courts. There are a lot of different reasons for that. But, you know, one is that the courts aren't as technologically accessible as they might be. The information about how they operate is not out there. There's a lack of education among the public about how things should operate. And these are all issues that this report is designed to address. Now, there's certainly not going to be some magic wand waved and all this is going to be fixed and the public is going to be in love with the courts overnight. But I think when you look at the recommendations of the report, we were driven not just by trying to figure out what is the best technology, what are the things we need to be doing, how do we need to be sure that people continue to act professionally, how do we, you know, figure out how to select the best judges. But at the end of the day, wanting to achieve an outcome that would increase the confidence that the public has in the courts. Because after all, the judicial branch is the third branch of government. And if the courts are not functioning properly, we do not have a properly functioning democracy. Mm. It's very important.
A recent opinion poll sponsored by your commission also indicated that 40% of respondents believe that whites were treated the same as everyone else in the state's courts. But that number dropped to 33% when asked about the treatment of African Americans and to 28% when it came to Hispanics. When those numbers dropped to 33 and 28%, is that how African Americans and Hispanics responded, or are these the impressions of all the people you asked?
I believe, I don't have the survey right in front of me, but I believe that this was questions that were posed to the population in general. I don't think people were singled out by race or ethnic origin.
So what that indicates is that white people would have said that African Americans and Hispanics are not as well treated as they are in the courts?
Well, I think aside from who it is that was doing the responding, I think that that is a perception that is out there that many people hold. And it is clearly something that we need to address by having a diverse judicial branch and by being sure that everybody who comes into our judicial branch is treated properly and equally.
Now, if I understand this correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong. There were three previous commissions aimed at repairing the state's courts. One came in the post-Reconstruction era in the 1800s. Then again in the 1950s, the Bell Commission, which we've referred to, envisioned this unified, uniform court system, which finally emerged in the 1970s, you say. So why did it take so long, and will it take that long for your recommendations to take hold?
You know, I think that the most recent commission before this one, the Medlin Commission, that got mired down in politics, is my understanding of how that occurred. Although there were some great recommendations, some of the recommendations that we're including as well. You know, I think one of the issues that you raise is the unified uniform, and we do have a unified system, but the mandate was not a uniform system, and I think that's where we've sort of gotten off the path and need to move towards more uniformity, certainly to enable technology to work as it should. I know one of the things, and Catherine can speak to this in more detail than I can, the Bar Association was looking to provide some support to the judicial branch in going forward, and it's very, very difficult right now to get good analytics and metrics from our system. And what we've tried to do with the report is to have data-driven solutions to the problems that we've seen, so that we can help quantify those and let the public know that we're making progress and positive progress towards resolving the problems.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And Mike, if I could just add to that, I think this is a very, very important point. In addition to commissioning the survey that we talked about a moment ago, the Chief Justice also wanted to examine the economic impact that the courts were having on our state. And so the Bar Association provided a grant. We found an economist. We were going to undertake this study. And we're very surprised to learn that AOC, this is not its fault, but it does not keep data in a consistent way over time.
AOC is what?
I'm sorry, the Administrative Office of the Courts.
Okay.
The data that it has is limited. And ultimately, we were able to dig down into the data that it does have and produce a report that I think outlined very clearly how significant from an economic point of view courts are to the health of a state. But in performing that work that the Chief Justice requested, I think it enabled us to focus on the fact that the deficiencies that we do have in technology leads to our not having the data that enables us to make as good a decision as we can. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, if you will. And I think what Justice Jackson was saying a moment ago is that, you know, the courts are going to try to take it's one step at a time to get where we need to get technology-wise and also to mine the data that will help us make these good decisions, particularly where we have, as she points out, a unified court system, but it isn't uniform because every county has its own local rules. Every county has its own peculiarities about the way it operates. And, you know, we're going to have to change some of that in order to bring some really good, real-time, 21st century solutions to our citizens.
Why is it still that way? If this commission in the 1950s recommended and tried to work toward a unified, uniform court system, why are there courts in certain areas of the state working differently with their own rules?
Well, you have to remember that when this uniform court system was put in place, they did not wrest, if you will, the courthouses out of the hands of the county commissioners. Those properties continue to be owned by them. You have local chief judges who make decisions about what the local rules are going to be. And it's done consistently within the current framework that we have. So a lot of this is simply historic. And it's something we're going to have a dialogue about as we go forward. Go
ahead.
It's interesting. Judge Rich Leonard, who's now Dean Leonard at Campbell University Law School, was on the technology committee. And one of the reasons that he was so helpful to us is that he had been involved in the development of the PACER system, which is the federal e-filing system. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he really cautioned when he was talking to us was the need for uniformity. One of the things that they ran into in the Eastern District of North Carolina was every court could set up its own definitions across the country. So federal practitioners, you know, would have to figure out how to do something in the Western District of North Carolina that might be different from the Eastern District of North Carolina. And that's something we're very attuned to. Local rules have a long history in the courts.
And Justice Jackson, the Medlin Review that you referred to a minute ago, which was the one in the 1990s, was started because I understand the public was frustrated by delay, by partiality, by lenience on crime. And that commission determined that the system was structurally incapable of responding to ongoing societal change and delivering the quality of justice that the public sought. That came from, I guess, their report. And you say it made a number of bold recommendations, the most important of which were either not adopted or significantly weakened. How do you ensure that that will not be the fate of what you're recommending?
Mike, this is Catherine. If I could intervene here, the Legal Professionalism Committee also looked at these issues. And if you look at that portion of the report that our committee generated, you will see that we recommended the creation of a legal innovation center. I think one of the challenges we have is that if we look at the court system every 30 or 40 years, we are by that time so far out of date that we're just playing catch up all the time. Mm-hmm. And what we're recommending is that we try to catch up, but that we also create a legal innovation center within the administrative office of the courts, hopefully. I don't know where the Chief Justice would elect to put it, but that might make some sense. And that center employ a small group of people whose job it is to pay attention year in and year out to what's going on in the courts and seeing that we make the changes we need as we need those changes, instead of waiting 20 or 30 or 40 years to have a commission come in and go, oh dear, look how far behind we are. It is the only way that we can stay ahead of the curve.
And if I can just add to that, too, specifically within technology, one of the charges the General Assembly made to us was to hire an outside consultant to develop a strategic plan. And we have a very good strategic plan for moving forward. But one of the primary things our consultants cautioned us about was that it's not static, that you need to keep adding to your strategic plan year after year. You have a five-year plan, but when you're done with year one, you move on to year two, and mm-hmm. you take a look out to year six then, so that it stays a five-year plan.
The court system has chronically complained of being underfunded. We've done programs on this several times in the past, and you point out that the 2008 recession dramatically affected the court system state funding. Well, now the economy has recovered. Has the economic outlook of the courts improved?
Well, the fact of the matter is, if you look at the numbers, the courts actually contribute positively to the general fund. Between filing fees and, I mean, the courts are very efficient. They're probably the most efficient branch of government we've got. And a lot of the court's money gets diverted to other purposes. Now, as a trial lawyer, that's a little bit of a sore point for me, but that's what happens. And we just don't get back as much money as we generate. We have been very thankful that the legislature 2 years ago increased court funding. And we are hopeful that they will continue to support. I think many in the legislature recognize that we have got to do better by the courts from a funding point of view. And also Chief Justice Martin has been...
Let me stop you there because we have to take a break. Sure. We'll come back on the other side, let you finish that. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Tree Care, providing residential and commercial general tree care, specializing in tree health care services. Carolina Tree Care's passion is to maintain and care for the canopy of the Carolinas. Information at carolinatreecare.com. And Bojangles, featuring the Cajun filet biscuit, a seasoned chicken breast on a made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit, served all day, every day at area Bojangles. Nationalism has seen resurgence from the Brexit vote to the election of Donald Trump. It was also a campaign theme in this weekend's presidential vote in France. But foreign policy expert Anne-Marie Slaughter says we should embrace global connections, and she will join Tom Ashbrook followed by a look at the first round results of that French vote coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point here on WFAE. Want to join our conversation? Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Join us on Facebook or on Twitter.
All Things Considered on WFAE puts you in touch with people and their stories.
The day you get out of jail, you're coming home to nothing and you have to start from scratch. You can't get a job some of these places when they see the criminal background. The only thing you want to do is like, I'm going back to selling drugs. And that kind of gets people back into that same cycle.
There's more to every story.
Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the recommendations put forth by the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice. We'll get to those in a minute. About overhauling the court system with Catherine Arrowwood, who's an attorney with Parker Poe and a former president of the North Carolina Bar Association, and Barbara Jackson, associate justice with the North Carolina Supreme Court. Just prior to the break, Catherine, you were talking about how the courts actually generate a lot of money for the general fund. You're giving more money in and you're not getting as much back, and the impact of that.
Yeah, and what I wanted to just conclude by saying on that topic is that, number one, the legislature has increased the amount of money that the courts get, which is a good thing. Second of all, I think Chief Justice Martin has been an incredible steward of the money that we do get. And the clerks, the people who operate the courthouses across the state are to be complimented on how they have managed to do a lot with very little during the recession. But we are hopeful that you know, we will continue to be doing a lot with very little, but that little will increase a bit, particularly in the area of, you know, salaries for some of the people who work for the courts, who are just incredible public servants. And as we move into improving the technology for the courts, we hope we can do things better, faster, and continue to be extremely efficient.
Are the salaries for those working in the court system for the jobs that they do, are they underpaid?
Well, in some segments they are. I mean, you look at, you know, clerks and others, judges who are in a district where they have a very light caseload. You have judges in other districts where they have a very heavy caseload. You know, this is a complicated issue, and it's one that does bear some further discussion.
Does it hinder the courts in able to get in their ability to get and attract and keep good people?
I think the answer, at least from my point of view as a trial lawyer, not speaking as a co-chair of this commission, but as a trial lawyer, I think the answer is not yet. We continue to attract very good quality judges in this state. We're very thankful that there are people who are very dedicated to serving as judges, because it is a very hard job. But this is an issue that needs to be constantly reexamined and not every 30 years.
Let's talk about some of these recommendations that the commission is making. You are recommending raising the juvenile age from 16 to 18 years old for crimes other than violent felonies and traffic offenses. You call this an important situation in which following the law itself may lead to outcomes that are unfair and unwise, even if they are lawful. Explain that.
Well, just to put that in context, North Carolina is now the last state in the country to have not raised the age. New York was right ahead of us, but they had a bill signed a couple weeks ago that raises the age. And I think that where this comes from is, again, this is data driven. And is based on the fact that teenagers don't have the maturity of judgment that adults do, and that there's a correlation there with culpability. Now, again, that doesn't apply to serious crimes, the most serious felonies, and there's still discretion within the purview of the district attorneys. But this is an important enough issue that the commission and the chief justice were able to pull together district attorneys, sheriff's association, police chiefs association, so it has very broad-based support even within the folks that are charged with enforcing the law.
So we all know, because studies have come out in recent years about this, that young people's brains aren't fully developed in their teen years. We know that for men, that development may continue into the mid-20s and beyond. Yet, as you said, we're the last holdout of treating 16 and 17-year-olds as adults in the court system. If you can't vote and you can't drink, and there's so many other things that you can't do as a teenager, why would you treat them in a criminal court or even a traffic court as an adult?
Well, that's the point. You know,
If I understood this, you're saying for crimes other than violent felonies and traffic offenses, you are advocating raising the age to 18 for being tried in an adult court. A 16-year-old breaks the law in a car with a traffic offense. Why should he or she be tried as an adult?
Yeah, and I was not on that committee, so I don't know if they had a discussion about that precise issue. So I don't want to make an assumption based upon not having served on that committee.
So I guess the question then would be, what crimes, at what age, if you're under 18, what crimes would make you eligible to be tried under these new recommendations in an adult court?
Well, my understanding is that the more violent crimes have been carved out, and that there are, as Justice Jackson indicated, they're going to leave with the prosecutor some discretion, depending on the nature of the crime. But the idea here is that for the vast majority of crimes that are committed by people under the age of 18, they will not be tried as an adult.
Is that how the other 49 states do it now?
Yes. And the statistics and the studies, and again, I was not on this committee, but this is an issue that has troubled me for many years. And I can say, I know that during the town hall meetings that we had around the state, this was the single most talked about issue. Family members, teachers, all kinds of people, police officers for that matter, coming in front of us and saying, you need to raise the age. It is not right to prosecute these kids as adults for these more minor offenses. It ruins their life. They can never get shed of it. It's a very difficult situation. And there's a whole bunch of data that backs up this being the right thing to do within our justice system.
And if we may...
And just,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Just to mention the public hearings again, all the district court judges in the Wilmington area came to the public hearing to support raising the age. That was the reason they came. That was their central concern. And I think that speaks volumes, too, is, again, the broad base of support from law enforcement and from the court system all agreeing to raise the age. And I also had the opportunity to serve on the courts commission, and the courts commission had a robust discussion about this issue and agreed that legislation should be put forth to raise the juvenile age, which it has been.
And if we raise the age, would that also cause juvenile offenders not to be put in the adult general population of prisons or in jails around the state?
Yes. That's one of the things the secretary, or I apologize, administrator of juvenile justice in North Carolina was involved in this whole process as well. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a recognition that there will be a cost to making this change so that juveniles get treated in a more therapeutic than punitive way, but that it's a great investment in our future.
Let me just add
one quick comment about this. The people who have been involved in juvenile justice in this state for the last at least 30 or 40 years have been urging us to do this, because when those young people end up in the general adult prison population, the chance that they're going to come out of that incarceration situation and not commit additional crimes, goes way down.
Why are we so
and
far?
If
why
we
are...
have them in a different location, segregated, and getting the help that they need, they have a much better prospect of becoming productive citizens. So it is a piece of legislation that is very data-driven, and there's a lot of evidence that shows it is the right thing to do.
Why are we so far behind the curve? We're the last of 50 states to make this decision.
Have you got about 5 hours?
Nope.
I think it would take us too long to have that discussion, but it is what it is. But I think those of us who've been practicing law in this state for a long time are very grateful that the Chief Justice is pushing this forward, because it's very important.
You mentioned, Justice Jackson, that there would be a cost to making this change. What kind of a cost? Why would there be a cost to this?
Well, again, if you're dealing with a more therapeutic model rather than a punitive model.
But isn't that a lot cheaper than putting a kid in jail?
I think it's probably going to be more expensive to
really
go the therapeutic way. But again, that's the short-term investment. The long-term investment is that you don't have kids getting co-opted into the lifestyle of the criminal population in the adult centers.
So if this recommendation were to be passed into law and it was adopted, would it be retroactive to those serving time as adults if they committed their crimes under the age of 18?
That's obviously a matter that is going to be debated and discussed, and I don't think we know how that is going to play out in the legislature.
A previous commission made recommendations on how we choose and retain judges, and this one is making recommendations as well. So correct me if I'm wrong, but although that's a goal you've set, you didn't really – I couldn't find any particulars in terms of what you put forth on how to achieve that. Is that accurate?
I think that's fair to say. You know, this is an issue that has been hotly debated, not just in North Carolina, but all across the country. We pick judges different ways in different states, and why states do it differently is a bit of a mystery. Some of it is very much historically rooted, and it is a debate that continues to go on today. I think even among lawyers in North Carolina, if you got 14 lawyers together, you'd probably have at least 10 different ways that they think judges ought to be selected. We are simply hopeful that the legislature will recognize that we need to have further dialogue about this. And speaking personally, again, the commission certainly has not done this. I think many of us who are trial lawyers believe that partisan elections is really not very helpful because judges are not making decisions based on political platforms for parties, but they're trying to bring justice to the citizens of our state. And again, let me just be very clear that that is my personal view, but I do think it is the view of many lawyers
across the state. The legislature just made judicial elections partisan.
Yes, they did. We are back to where we were 40 years ago.
And a lot of people, particularly people on the right, perceive the judicial system as being politically biased, because if a judge goes against the legislature or the Congress, then they are activist judges. They're not interpreting the law. They're writing law. How do you get beyond that?
Well, I don't know how you get beyond it, because people are going to believe what they want to believe on that topic. I think it is fair to say, and again, as I'm speaking here as a practicing lawyer, I'm not speaking as a member of the commission or even with my bar association hat on, we have one of the finest judiciaries in this state. We certainly have some folks maybe who don't act the way they should, but by and large, we have a very, very fine judiciary. And I really do hate to see it get tinkered with for political partisan purposes, because the confidence, you know, we've seen the survey. And we've already seen that many of our citizens don't have confidence in the judiciary. And part of it is because of this rhetoric about activist judges and that sort of thing. The fact of the matter is, the reality of it is, these judges are doing a great job, and they really bring justice to our state.
Barbara Jackson,
and we need to stand behind them.
You are on the Supreme Court. You are a justice. Do you think it's a good or a bad idea to have an R or a D next to your name? Should we be electing judges in the first place? Because most people who go to vote don't know anything about judges.
You know, that's something I get asked a lot, and I think I will refrain from weighing in on the partisan issue. I've run 2 nonpartisan elections. Clearly, my next election will be partisan. But I think in terms of information, this is one thing that I find a little frustrating. Back in 2004, the state started publishing a voter's guide for members of the judiciary. So we all fill out bios, and that gets sent across the state for the appellate courts. Every judge I know has a website, a Facebook page. Some of us have Twitter accounts. So we're really easy to do some research on from that standpoint. Hmm. And, you know, I don't think that it's harder to find out who we are than most other candidates, if you're interested.
So let's talk about something else that you point out in this report, that there are more lawyers practicing now than ever before, but the legal needs of citizens are increasingly going unmet. Is that across the board, or is that mainly among those who can't afford proper representation?
It's actually across the board. This is the subject matter of my committee. You know, we have a whole slew of people out there who are poor and need legal help. And we have legal aid, and I'll put in a plug, again, not with my commission hat on, but put in a plug for legal aid right here. It does a marvelous job of really helping our poorest citizens get protection. But we really do have a problem with the middle class. We've gotten into a situation where we have a large number of highly educated lawyers who've got a lot of law school debt, who can't afford to go practice law in a small town because they've got to pay that debt off. And these folks, average folks around the state who need to get legal advice, can't afford to get it from these people. We actually had the Wake County Domestic Court take a look at what was going on there, and found that in something like 50% of the divorce cases that come in front of the Wake County Domestic Court, there are no lawyers representing either side. It is a cost to the courts because it takes judges longer to process cases when there is not legal representation. And so one of the things that we have recommended in the legal professionalism portion of the report is that there be a careful examination of who we are permitting to provide legal services. Should we consider alternatives in terms of letting legal professionals who are not fully educated lawyers, 3 years of law school and 4 years of college, these are issues that need further study. They cannot be decided without careful study, and one of our recommendations is that we take a look at that.
You're also right. Go ahead.
It's interesting. One of the things that came up in the technology committee is sort of the brave new world that we've entered into. One example was a student at Stanford University who has set up a website or an app to take care of parking tickets for people. And the way he makes money is that he takes a spread between the price they would have paid and the price that they actually pay. So there's a lot of entrepreneurship going on. Within the legal profession.
We have 20 seconds left. There are other recommendations that you made, including improving civic education in schools. But what happens next? To make these recommendations real, does it all have to go through the General Assembly? Now we have about 10 seconds left.
Civics education, we've got it right now. If you want somebody to come speak to your class, a judge or a lawyer, get in touch with the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts.
Okay. Barbara Jackson is an associate justice with the North Carolina Supreme Court. Catherine Arrowwood is an attorney at Parker Poe in Raleigh and the former president of the North Carolina Bar. And both are co-chairs of the North Carolina Commission on the Administration of Law and Justice. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.